Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
Welcome to the Tom Hartman Program,
your home for truth in broadcasting.
Now, here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom in the American way. Oh, we're going to have a great program today. At the end of our third hour, the last half hour of our program, Peter Yarrow, Peter Perrin, Paul and Mary is going to drop by. We're going to have Congressman Robert Wexler in our second hour. Terry Jeffrey is going to talk with us about the conservative take on the news, particularly in oil drilling. And so in our first hour, I really want to get into the issue that I think is, you know, clearly the war is a big issue. And in fact, I would say the war is a large part of the issue of the economy. It's ultimately always the economy, stupid, as the old sign from the Clinton campaign. And I want to get into these issues around what's going on with the economy. And to some extent, that means what's going on with oil. And also, as I said, what's going on with impeachment. And one of the most progressive members of the House of Representatives is Peter DeFazio. He's the representative from the 5th District of Oregon. Congressman DeFazio. 4th District. Thank you very much. That's me. I live in the 5th District, I think.
Yeah.
In any case. Yeah.
I always mix the numbers up, too.
Yeah, there you go.
I know mine.
Yeah. Well, that's a good thing. It's a very good thing. So Congressman Peter DeFazio is with us, and defazio.house.gov is his website. And Congressman, I am being inundated, and I suspect that there are boiler rooms running this thing. I'm getting the emails. Mostly, though, what I'm seeing is postings on websites, on blog sites, and calls to talk radio shows, both left and right. And I've been noticing, I'm a fairly heavy consumer of talk radio, and we're also noticing that here, particularly on the local show on 620 KPOJ, people who seemed, it almost seems like the operation has been rolled out again, where people are paid for every time that they can get on the air, every time they make a blog posting. I know during the election of 2004, there was a group associated with the Republicans who were paying people 10 cents a post for every post that they got on a national blog. We had one of those guys who was, spamming our blog, and he eventually came clean about it after the election. In fact, he tracked us back to some of the information on it. This time it seems to be from the oil industry saying that, you know, we need to open up ANWR and the reason oil prices are so high is because we haven't given away enough to the oil industry and they need more giveaways. They need more land. Do I hear you chuckling in the background?
Yeah, there's no shortage of crude for one thing. Remember, oil went up $11 a barrel on Friday while demand is plummeting for the finished product. The immediate crunch in the U.S. is shortage of refinery capacity, and ExxonMobil says, hey, we're not going to build any more refineries. In fact, we've been closing refineries. Valero, second largest producer, saying we're doing very well the way it is. We're not going to build refineries. Yet the Republicans talk about Democrats are preventing refineries. No, the industry has been colluding to close refineries, make them more profitable, restrict supply, use as an excuse to drive up the price. Second big factor is speculation. We don't know how big it is. Estimates are 50 cents a gallon. That's the Enron loophole. Ken Lay, he's dead. Enron, they're bankrupt. But the loophole they got for energy and commodities trading lives on.
In the last year of the Clinton administration, wasn't it?
Yeah, Clinton signed it to his discredit. Yeah. The Republicans put it through Congress, but Clinton did a lot of bad things, and that was one of them.
Yeah, so, I didn't mean that as a gratuitous swipe at Clinton. I just, you know,
I mean, he did. I mean, he shouldn't have. I mean, yeah. I voted against it. It was pretty clear to see what totally deregulating these commodities markets and allowing them to create these incredible speculative instruments. I mean, it's driving up the price of food, driving up the price of fuel. Then third, you have collusion by OPEC, and instead of filing a complaint under the WTO, which they're violating Article 20 of GATT, Clinton goes over, holds hands with the Saudi princes, begs, and then they say no.
You mean Bush?
Those are the,
Bush
does. I got Clinton vote Bush, yeah. And so here we are. Those are the major factors. And what are they talking about? They're saying, "Well, we need more leases." Well. Gee, right. If we need more leases, why don't they first develop the ones they have? Remember, and this was why I got Clinton on the brain, Clinton leased the Naval Petroleum Reserve to the oil industry 8 years ago. 25 right. exploratory wells. We know there's a sea of oil under there. We've been sitting on that for 75 years, and we know we don't know if there's oil on Anwar. They haven't developed one producing well. None.
Why not? Why not? You think they're just just sitting on this stuff until the price goes to $2.50 a barrel?
Why not?
Yeah. Yeah.
And then the same thing offshore. They've got 10,000 permits onshore and offshore that they haven't developed. The estimates from our own mineral management service is that 80% of the available or potential oil offshore is already available under existing permits, but 6,492 of them are not yet developed. There's other estimates that there's the 68 million acres of land that they've leased, but right. Land and water that are currently idle could produce another 4.8 million barrels of oil a day, 44 billion cubic feet of natural gas each day. That would double our production
domestically.
Of oil. Now, why aren't they developing those things? They don't need a whole bunch more leases to get a property right on to sit on forever. What they need to do is go out and develop stuff.
So the question, why aren't they developing it?
Because they're making a pile of money. Why would they develop it?
Right. Why should they bring more product onto the market and drive down the price?
Right.
But you just pointed out when we first started that there is more product on the market, the demand is dropping, and the price is going up. So it seems that even bringing more product on the market would necessarily hurt them as long as they control the price at the market.
Well, even the Bush administration is beginning to investigate collusion in the commodities markets regarding energy prices. I mean, even the Bush administration, we should just close the darn loophole and not allow them to do that. But even they feel that they have to investigate this. And I have the independent petroleum distributors in. There's a few of them left. And they said to me, okay, who's the largest holder of oil and gas right now in the U.S.? And I said, ExxonMobil. They said, no, Morgan Stanley.
You're kidding.
I don't know if that's true or not.
Morgan Stanley is the largest holder of oil and gas in the United States?
Of because of the contracts that they're holding.
Oh, right? So they're holding the leases on the land that have not been developed.
Leases. No, the contracts for
the contracts for oil. Right. So then they are speculating on oil. They're buying this stuff up. They're buying low and planning to sell high, and as long as the price keeps being driven up, as long as they keep buying, it drives up the price. As long as the price goes up, they have an appreciating asset. What we're seeing here, could it be, Congressman, we're talking with Congressman Peter DeFazio, his website, defazio.house.gov. Could it be that we have actually seen an economy that is simply a series of bubbles? There was the dot-com bubble, then the real estate bubble, and now we're seeing this commodities bubble, and that what it is that there's all this investment cash, there's all this money looking for homes, and basically it's being churned. We're going through this because we no longer manufacture anything in the United States. We don't have a core economy that anybody can invest in any longer. So instead, it's all become it's become Las Vegas.
Kevin Phillips, Bad Money. I recommend the book.
I've read it and I've talked with him, and that's the basic thesis of his book.
Sure.
And I was just looking to you for a congressional validation.
Oh,
of it. You
no.
believe that that's
I mean,
the case?
Absolutely. That's going on. But remember, again, back to the Enron loophole. We have made the commodities markets and derivatives totally opaque. They can trade off the books. They can collude
right.
with the numbers.
We can see
another
nothing.
Trading company say, hey, let's ratchet up the market today, just like Enron did with electricity.
Right.
Let's send the price skyrocketing. And that's what happened last Friday. They, you know, there was that kind of collusion going on where they bid on each other's
stuff
back and forth.
Here's a political question then. To the extent that it's to the advantage of Rex Tillerson and his buddies, the CEO of ExxonMobil and his buddies in the oil industry, for there to be a Republican in the White House, why would they be doing this at this point of time in the election cycle? Or do you expect that in August or September we're going to see the price of oil start dropping precipitously?
That's an interesting question, but you also talked about this unbelievable coordinated effort. Last week they killed off a critical issue for Western counties, particularly my district, county school payments over the issue of offshore drilling and ANWR drilling.
Right.
The mess, every bill that has come up in the last 2 weeks, the bill to allow soapbox derby on Capitol Hill, the bill to support nanotechnology, county payments, the Republicans get up and they say, the Pelosi premium, drill, we have to drill more on the, we need more leases, we need to drill ANWR, and this is a very coordinated campaign. I think they've got a focus group. They say Newton is now writing the playbook again, and they think that maybe they can pin these high oil prices on the Democrats and scramble back into power.
Okay, so they keep the oil prices high and they all point it back to Nancy Pelosi and
amazing.
Well, you know, if they're cynical and craven enough, and they certainly have demonstrated that in the past, it might work, which is a horrible thought.
Still, people see the quarterly profit statements from the oil companies.
Yeah. Peter DeFazio, Congressman Peter DeFazio, DeFazio.house.gov. Thanks, Congressman, for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
The Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People.
Paul and Murray as well. The travel gods willing, he will be in our studio here at the bottom of the third hour at 11:30 Pacific time, 2:30 Eastern time. So we'll see. You know, I'm looking forward to that. Let me just get right down to what's going on here. I mean, who are the fat cats killing our economy? How are they doing it, and why? And there's a bunch of pieces to this, and there's a bunch of interlocking pieces to this, frankly, and I think it's really important to point them out. One of them, Peter DeFazio just said, okay, the strategy, and I thought this was fascinating, he pointed out that apparently Newt Gingrich is now running the Republican strategy machine, which makes perfect sense. The strategy is to attach to every piece of legislation the Pelosi premium, to get that word out there in everybody's mind, to repeat it over and over and over again, and to try to keep bringing this back to, it's all the Democrats' fault that the price of oil is high because they're not drilling, because we haven't opened up ANWR. When in fact, the majority of the oil leases out there are not even being used by the oil companies. All this oil under the ground, not that it necessarily should be. I'm frankly not an advocate of burning more oil. But in terms of the price, this is a manipulation. This is a system that is being manipulated. Add to that, for example, things like John McCain and Airbus. This is all about ripping off as much as possible from America, from Americans, of America. This is an ad about John McCain and the Airbus contract that is running.
Some straight talk about John McCain. A French company, Airbus, and an American company, Boeing, were competing for a contract worth up to $100 billion. Seven of McCain's staff and fundraisers lobbied for Airbus. McCain got more money from Airbus's U.S. executives than any other politician. And guess what? John McCain intervened, which helped Airbus get that Pentagon contract. Tell John McCain to kick those lobbyists off the Straight Talk Express.
Yeah, good luck. Good luck that might happen. So here we have, you know, John McCain and his lobbyists on his campaign committee, on his staff, trying to blow a contract out of the water, an American firm, Boeing, and instead hand it off to Airbus, a European company. Why? Well, obviously, because they're making a whole pile of money off this, another piece of this thing. But the bottom line, there's something much larger than that. And I think something emblematic of it is, for example, today, this in the New York Post, the latest Big Apple trophy being coveted by oil-rich sovereign wealth funds is the landmark Chrysler building. The Abu Dhabi Investment Council is going to buy the Art Deco treasure that has defined the Midtown skyline since 1930. This follows last month's sale of the GM building and three other properties for $3.95 billion to a group of investors, including the wealth funds of Kuwait and Qatar. And it goes on and on and on. The bottom line is, since Reagan, we've seen home mortgages go from in the neighborhood of a little over $1 trillion. That's the debt of all the American people. We've seen the home mortgages go from that to over $8 trillion right now. So, you know, I have cons and they say, oh, you know, the economy is great. Just look around. Look at all the houses that people own. No, people don't own their houses anymore. People don't own their cars anymore. People are leasing their cars, basically renting them. Consumer debt has gone from $2 trillion under, you know, toward the end of Reagan, this is 1987, to today over $11 trillion. We're broke. National debt. The national debt, when Reagan came into office, just in the neighborhood of, you know, $1.5-$2 trillion, he drove that thing up to around five. Now we're pushing $9 trillion. The Republican borrow and spend philosophy has bankrupted America. But perhaps more important is the balance of trade deficit. People don't get that there's a difference. And I know it sounds esoteric, but there's a difference between the national debt and the balance of trade deficit. The national debt is how much money our government spends more than it takes in. Okay, it's just plain old debt. That's like you're spending money on your credit card and you don't have the paycheck coming in. That's the national debt. The balance of payments is the amount of stuff that we're buying from other countries that isn't balanced by stuff we sell to them. So if we buy $1 trillion worth of stuff from other countries, and that amount, by the way, in 2006, the trade deficit, $765 billion. When Bush came into office, it was only in the neighborhood of $300 billion. It's more than doubled. That money, when we buy stuff from foreign countries, they're now sitting on that money, and where can they spend dollars? Here. That's it. So it's like going to somebody and saying, hey, you know, I'd like to buy that big screen TV for $5,000, you know, a big super deluxe one. And, you know, but I don't have your cash to give you. So I'll tell you what, I'll give you my front porch. Then you go to somebody else and you say, you know, I'd like to buy that car. Well, I'll give you my bedroom, or I'll give you my living room. Basically, what we have been doing is we've been selling off America. Foreign ownership in the United States now, over $2 trillion worth of American companies have been sold off to foreign firms. $2,071,961,000,000 worth of American companies sold off. All the profits, all the taxes, now going overseas.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Call Tom at 866-303-2278.
Yes, you tell them, Jim Morrison. Man, my favorite part of that song is where he goes, they got the guns, but we got the numbers. here it comes.
May take all we got, it may take long ago. They got the guns, but we got the numbers. Gonna win, yeah, we're taking over.
Yeah, we're taking over! And that's what we've got to do. Infiltrate from the bottom up. Show up at Democratic Party events, show up at Green Party events, show up at Republican Party events, whatever your personal preference would be, get involved in the political process. It's not enough to just vote. Too much is at stake now. It's too important. By the way, welcome back to the Tom Hartman program, brought to you in part by the Teamsters, fighting to start the unfair trade deal with Colombia. Find out more about that over Teamster.org. And some downright strange, crazy stuff going on in the world out there. Yeah, first of all, this, as they say from the wire services, Republican presidential nominee John McCain officially kicked off his general election campaign today, promising to bring his race to the White House to all 13 colonies. As a campaign stop in the Dominion of Virginia, Senator McCain said of his Democratic opponent, Senator Barack Obama, takes any of the 13 colonies for granted, quote, he doth so at his peril. Senator McCain made his remarks in the Dominion of Virginia, which many McCain advisors concede will be a key colony in the fall election. But in announcing his 13-colony strategy, Senator McCain appeared to give notice that he intends to contest such traditional Democratic strongholds as the province of Massachusetts Bay. Uh-oh. In the conclusion of his remarks, Senator McCain vowed that his campaign would employ the latest technology to spread his message across the 13 colonies. We will use, he said, the telegraph key, the pony, and the carrier pigeon. This, by the way, thanks from Andy Borowitz, BorowitzReport.com, for the finest news of the day, as it were. The carrier pigeon.
Farmer had raised chickens since he was 24. All working for the colonel for 30 years or more. Killing all the chickens and sending them to fried. Now it's payback time for ghost chickens in the sky.
Ghost chickens in the sky? Well, sort of. New facial treatment. Geisha bird poop facial? Shizuka, a New York spa run by a master aesthetician, Shizuka Bernstein. It offers the latest trend in skincare, the geisha facial. New facial treatment is made from bird poop, what can you say? And has been coined the bird poop facial by fans and curious spectators. Nightingale droppings, actually. I'm telling you, you got to be careful with that stuff because it could be pigeons. And, you know, those pigeons are actually robots from the planet Xenu. How do you know? Well, because every time there's a meeting of world leaders anywhere, or, you know, big shots are getting, or even if you're talking about something really confidential with somebody, look around. There will be pigeons. They're spies. Number one. Number two, have you ever seen a dead pigeon? Nah. They're robots. Number three, you never seen a baby pigeon? Of course not. They're robots. The mothership comes and opens up, you know, every year or maybe every 6 months, the mothership comes and drops a new load of robots down with their little recording devices and picks up the current load, and off they go. And so, anyhow, that's our crazy alert for the... No, I don't really believe that, but I like to think that I do. By the way, we're video streaming now. It seems to be working again. We have a link to it from our front page at TomHartman.com, also at AirAmerica.com/TomVision. But there's also a hot link at TomHartman.com so that you get the spelling right and everything, because no matter how you spell TomHartman.com, it'll get you there. And we're going to have a contest today. In Sean Taylor, our producer's opinion, whatever her favorite post is to our blog on our homepage at TomHartman.com for today's show post, that person will win a copy of my book, Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What We Can Do About It. Ta-ta-da. So there we go. 1-866-303-2270, your telephone number. Is the price of oil and gas, or are the prices of oil and gas, being manipulated cynically? One of the folks in the chat room mentioned last night, Sean Hannity, was exactly on the point of what Peter DeFazio was saying. That they're going to try and blame all this on Nancy Pelosi and on the Democrats. And, yeah, they're all reading, I'm telling you, they're all reading from the same playbook. It's just that simple. Ernie in Lebanon, Oregon. Hey, Ernie, what's on your mind today?
Yes, sir. I'm a truck driver, and I was talking to another truck driver about a month ago. He was telling me that his best friend is in the oil well business, but he makes money drilling oil wells, but not pumping out the oil.
Right.
He's paid by the government to pump them and not pump the oil. So we're actually paying tax dollars to not pump oil.
Yeah, I'm telling you, the oil companies have got their hands in not just our back pocket. They got their hands in every pocket, and a whole lot of it is just like this whole McCain deal with Airbus Industries. It's like they don't care if it screws America and Americans. It's just off they go, and they're making a fortune. Michael in Templeton, California. Hey, Michael.
Hi, Tom. How you doing?
Just great, but I'll get better. What's on your mind today?
I'll get better than you then.
Okay. We got a competition here.
Okay.
What's on your mind, Mike?
What I wanted to say was that, remember last Friday when oil went up $11 a barrel?
Yeah.
One of the things that drove it up was an announcement by a Morgan Stanley analyst that the price target was going to be 150.
Yeah.
Well, isn't this curious, because Morgan Stanley owns more oil than anybody else, right?
That's according to Congressman DeFazio, the testimony before his committee. Yes, Morgan Stanley.
Market manipulation. And the investment banks are big practitioners of this. I'll give you another quick example. Last November, I'm listening to a financial show, and on Sunday, the guy says the word is out that Goldman Sachs is shorting the big banks. Well, the very next day, Goldman Sachs came out with this announcement. Oh, Citigroup's going to have a lot more losses. Bam, Citigroup stock goes down 6%.
And Goldman Sachs makes a pile of money on their short positions.
This
short
stuff
positions.
Goes on all the time.
Yeah. I'm telling you, it is. This is what Kevin Phillips wrote about in his book, Bad Money. Michael, thanks a lot for the call. This is when they say speculation. This is the kind of thing they're talking about. Thomas in Salt Lake City, Utah. Hey, Thomas.
Hi. How are you, Tom?
Just great. What's up?
Well, I have a suggestion for the congressman, if he's still listening by any chance.
They should draft
some legislation to revoke those permits. If they're not going to use them, give them to somebody who will.
Right. And for that matter, once the oil companies get these, once the oil companies get these permits and they start pumping the oil, they pay 12.5% of its market value. The rest of it is their money. They're buying the oil under our soil 12.5%. Mike in Garnion, Washington. Hey, Mike.
How you doing, Tom?
Fine. What's up?
Well, wasn't that caller yesterday to you that said, why don't we make this a public utility? I mean, is there any way?
Yeah.
We've discussed this before, I know, many times about nationalizing our oil, and I don't see why not. I mean, look at what the income could do for our infrastructure and yet to help the healthcare system.
Yeah, I mean, look at what Chavez is doing with it in Venezuela, or perhaps, a lot of people don't like Chavez. Look at what Mexico is doing with it in Mexico. I mean, and Russia, and although a lot of that has been privatized, they're renationalizing it in kind of backdoor ways, but... Yeah, and Mike, I think that is the scenario that has the oil company executives waking up in the middle of the night going, whoa. Tom in Miami. Hey, Tom.
Hey, I had an oil comment. First of all, Tom, I just want to say, you said the national debt was the difference between tax revenues and expenditures. That's the deficit. Of course, the debt is accumulated liability over time. And,
that's right. It's
there's more off-balance sheet liabilities on the federal government books than Enron could even dream up. But anyway, my point is, this talk about Fazio, this is the first time I've heard this develop. I'm kind of skeptical. It reminds me of Schumer. When he talked about bringing barrels online from Anwar, it would affect the price one penny. But when it comes from Saudi Arabia, he said it would be 62 cents. And you mentioned the point about the oil profits. The 12.5%, that's 12.5% more than the broadcast industry pays for using the public airwaves.
Actually, I don't know if that's true or not. Back in 96, the whole telecommunications bill and Reagan auctioning off the airwaves, I don't know the economics of that. But the public airwaves and oil are a little different. You don't put the public airwaves in your gas tank. Terry in Springfield. Hey, Terry.
Hi, Tom. Hey, I can't figure out why we keep going after the windfall profits, because it gives them that argument that hurts them going back and doing research and everything.
Right.
I think we should go after them to promote them to actually do the refining and tax them on those closed refineries, or even on the unpumped oil or unrefined oil, just like they do, cars. If they don't sell them by the end of the year, they get taxed on them sitting on their lots.
Oh, that's interesting. So, just consider it an asset, because they are. Yeah, you're right. They're getting a lot of tax breaks and things, depreciation, oil depletion allowance and all these other fancy little tax breaks that the oil companies get. That would be one more. John in Allentown, Pennsylvania. We've got a half a minute here, John, before this break is going to start.
Well, yeah, just real quick. I mean, they say they preach about drilling in Anwar, and everybody knows you're not going to see a drop of oil in 5 to 10 years.
Right.
And why don't the Democrats come up with something along the lines of, like, legislation saying we need to, you know, introduce something that's going to get us off of oil?
They've already, well, yeah, that absolutely needs to be done. And at the same time, during just during the 7 years of the Bush administration so far, the number of oil leases is up 300%. It's over 300%. I mean, it's like the oil companies are being handed oil by our government domestically. They're being handed oil. And they're saying, great, we'll take it. We'll buy that for pennies on the dollar. We'll buy that land, or we'll buy the leases on that land. And now we're going to sit on it. And as we watch the prices go up and up and up. And where does it stop? Well, today, or yesterday, I guess it was in today's news, one of the senior executives with Gazprom, which is the Russian national oil company, the biggest oil company in Russia, said, we're going to see oil at $250 a barrel. Soon. Yeah. 45 minutes past the hour.
Tom Hartman.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
What's Bush got to do with it? Who needs the law when the law can be broken, you know? He can just tell all the lies he wants. And he does, by the way. We'll get into that a little later with our revelation yesterday from John Bolton that he believes that under Article 51 of the UN, we can attack Iran right now. And I'm gonna, in the next hour, we're going to get into that with Robert Wexler. And this, I think, frankly, is a big deal. But, you know, coming back to the oil prices, I just wanted to give a tip of the hat to Shelley Drobny, who sent me a copy of a piece he wrote a while back that is the guy who was the original founder of Air America Radio. That is so right on, and I'm getting a forehead slap. I don't know why this I hadn't thought of this before. Shelley's smarter than I am when it comes to finance, I guess. But in any case, he says, if you want to see the price of oil drop in half, all Barack Obama has to do is announce in a very serious way a very large-scale Manhattan-style project to get us off the dependence of oil and to include the world in this, you know, to make this available to these kinds of technologies all around the world. What this will do is cause all the speculators to freak out because and Shelley's point is that, and it's right, that panic selling always goes faster than panic buying. It's why the NASDAQ dropped from 5,000 down to 2,000 in just a very, very short period of time, and it still hasn't recovered, you know, when the dot-com bubble burst. And so it's like, you know, yeah, stimulate panic selling of oil futures, and then we'll be bailing out Morgan Stanley. I mean, you know, this is the crazy thing. We don't make anything in America anymore. Instead, we've moved all our manufacturing overseas, and because we don't make anything, we're just handing money to each other. That's how people make money in America now, is with money, is buying and selling commodities, basically gambling on what the future value of commodities will be, whether it's rice or wheat or oil or gold or whatever it may be. And it's a lousy way to run a country. It's a lousy way to run an economy. It's frankly no way to run an economy. I mean, and we've seen this from the Dutch tulip bulb panic in the 1700s all the way up to today, over and over and over again. Whenever the speculators look at 1929, it was all about stocks. You know, the apocryphal story that Gloria Swanson, who was an old friend of mine before she died, she was on the board of directors of a community for abused kids that we started in 1978 in New Hampshire, New England Salem Children's Village, still there, still running. And I used to go down to New York a couple times a year, and we'd have dinner in her apartment. She'd tell me these wild stories about Joe Kennedy. And the story, it's been variously attributed to other people as well, but she said that, you know, Kennedy had said to her that one of his buddies had said to him that he knew that it was time to get out of the stock market when it was either the taxi driver or the shoeshine boy was offering him stock tips. And at that point, he said, okay, this is the top of the market. Now is the time to bail out. Anyhow. Lot to do with this. David in Monroe, Louisiana. Hey, David, what's on your mind?
Hello, Tom. I just wanted to ask you, how come we can't, since we the people are the government, how come we can't take over the oil fields offshore since nobody owns that property out there?
Well, we have. And what we do is we lease or rent those oil fields to the oil companies and say, okay, and it's cheap. I mean, you know, it's a few cents an acre. And then when they find oil and they drill the oil out, it's 12.5% of whatever the market value of that oil is what they pay us. And so, you know, we have to decide, is that 12.5% right? You know, because obviously the revenues are going up as the price of oil goes up. Should it be 15%? Should it be 20%? Or should we create a government oil company? I'm not a big fan, frankly, of government-owned industries. But on the other hand, we're talking about something here that is at some level essential for the running of our nation. I do think that while I wouldn't be necessarily in favor of a government-run oil company, I would think that government market subsidies to solar, wind, to renewable energies, the way Jimmy Carter did, you know, we just need to do that again. And that, by the way, is part of Barack Obama's platform and has been announced. We just need to do more of that kind of thing. But, you know, to the extent that we can own it, we still do own it. David, thanks for the call, though. Appreciate the question. Dan in Boston, Massachusetts. Hey, Dan.
Hey, Tom. Let me just stop by saying you are the man.
Without
guys like you, the cause would go nowhere. But I think this is a problem where deregulation meets capitalism. It's just gone totally amok. We've made all these people who used to be union laborers and union workers, we've made them all mid-level management, gave them 401k plans and a little bit of benefits, and they think they have a stake in the company, when in fact the CEOs and the people who own these companies think less of them than they do of people like me. We need to get back to organized labor, unions, strong unions. And
absolutely.
In the words of Abraham Lincoln, labor beats capital. Every time.
Yeah,
thanks,
well,
Link,
you're welcome. Thanks a lot, David. Dan, excuse me. And in fact, what Lincoln said is that labor is superior to capital because labor precedes capital. In other words, you don't have capital. You don't have money until somebody makes something. Labor is what creates it all. And Dan was absolutely spot on. We do need to bring democracy in the workplace back, which is unions. I mean, that's the bottom line. Mark in Boca Raton, Florida. Hey, Mark, you got a little less than a minute here before we got to wrap up this hour.
Okay, I've got a quick question and a follow-up. On the Airbus contract, doesn't that have to go to the lowest bidder on something like that?
No, it has to go to the best bidder. There's a whole lot of considerations beyond price. The lowest bidder could be offering a really lousy product, and you wouldn't want the government to buy that. But I think that we also should consider, and this is the part that hasn't been considered since basically Clinton with NAFTA and GATT, we need to consider the impact on the U.S. economy as part of the bid. If we're gonna export 14,000 jobs over to Europe to Airbus Industries, or we're gonna bring 14,000 jobs to the United States to Boeing, that seems to me like that's actually part of the bid. And it wasn't considered part of the bid. It was considered irrelevant. And in other words, the interests of working Americans don't matter. I think that they should matter. I think it's really important that they matter. So, anyhow, let's continue this conversation, in fact, with Terry Jeffrey. Terry Jeffrey is the editor-in-chief of the old conservative news service, now the Cybercast news service, CNSnews.com, right after the break. Stick around.
Tom Hartman.
Defending America from the weapons of mass deception.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Is the Tom Hartman Program.
You're in the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Now, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. 6 minutes past the hour, the second hour of our program. What's going on? I mean, this is the bottom line. Who are the fat cats who are killing our economy and why? I'm guessing that we may have some very different perspectives on this. Terry Jeffrey is the editor-in-chief of CNSnews.com, And Terry, welcome to the show.
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
Good, good. A couple of things I wanted to get through, talk with you about. First of all, you wanted to talk with me about what's going on with Cooper Union and the art display. Do you want to just toss that out, and then I want to get into oil with you.
Sure. What's happened at Cooper Union, which is a school for arts and sciences in New York City, hasn't got much press attention. The Catholic League for Religious and Civil Rights first drew attention to it. They had a student art exhibit that ended just the other day, in which they exhibited some art that is so disgusting, Tom, I really don't want to describe it too graphically on the air, but involved some prominent symbols of the Catholic Church, a crucifix and a rosary, being inserted in a man's posterior in drawings that this guy did. What the school did was they picked out these artworks as quote-unquote of the best of the students in the school, and they put them on display. And I think
this art exhibit was not paid for with government dollars, at least according to your article.
Right. Well, actually,
and this is a private school.
Here's the deal. This school, Cooper Union, received $4.6 million from the federal government over the last 8 years, according to our reporting, $122,000 of it in grants from the National Endowment for the Arts. No, there was not a direct grant, as far as we know anyway, from the government.
But let's assume for a moment that there was. Even if there was, isn't Don Rumsfeld right? Freedom is messy.
Look, Cooper Union has the freedom to do this. I would not for a minute suggest any kind of government regulation or law that would say Cooper Union could not display this student's art. They had
okay, and to the extent that, I don't know, maybe we disagree on this. You don't think that the government should fund arts of any sort in any way?
No, I do believe the government. I think actually the government funds too little art. I think, for example, in Washington, D.C., they've built some incredibly ugly federal buildings. I wish they
need some art. Yeah, I agree. Okay, so here we. It seems I'm a little baffled then, because if you agree with me that historically governments have always funded art. I mean, Beethoven couldn't have done what he did. Mozart couldn't have done what he did if they didn't have wealthy patrons or government,
sure.
which was the government back then.
Right.
Art typically it doesn't pay all that well. So if we have both agree that the government should be funding art,
right,
and we both agree that art is part of free expression, and we shouldn't have the government deciding what should or shouldn't be said or seen or done,
right,
then I don't understand, you know, why you got your noise out of a joint.
Well,
wait,
there's a couple of issues here. First of all, yes, I do believe the government should fund art.
But you want to decide what art is.
But wait a minute. I think they should fund art because I think it is a public good, and I think that we deserve to see beautiful things around us. When the government builds a building, there should be art in the building. The building itself should be art. But the government, therefore, chooses. Now, if the Congress of the United States were to decide to carve into the side of the U.S. Capitol a depiction of someone with a crucifix in their posterior, I think that would be a wrong choice by Congress.
I agree with you, and they get so much blowback they'd stop, and in all probability, Cooper Union is going to get so much blowback that they'll stop. I mean, you know, these things tend to work themselves out,
Terry.
You
know what's interesting, though, Tom, is that this story, it's got a little, you know, the AP put out a story about this, and USA Today, I think, had a little thing about it. But other than that, and here at Cybercast News Service, it's almost got no press. Well,
it could be because a lot of people are just seeing this as, oh, God, here go the cons again with their culture war stuff.
Well,
you know, Terry, I'll see your crucifix and raise you China.
But you know what, Tom, there's other issues here is, I mean, even though I can see Cooper Union has the freedom to do this, and that freedom should be defended, there really is an outrageous moral decision here by the administrators of Cooper Union to award and celebrate this particular work of art. There's no doubt that this work of art was designed to insult and affront Catholics. Now, I happen to be a Catholic. I mean, the correct term for this is blasphemy.
Yeah.
And so Cooper Union, this school, is celebrating blasphemy and the insulting of the Catholic Church.
So you're right there with the Muslims who think that the Danish newspapers who publish the cartoons of Muhammad with a bomb in his turban should be shut down or put out of business.
Look, I do not.
Those newspapers also receive government subsidies, just like newspapers in the United States
do.
I do
not think that people should. I disagree with doctrines of the Muslim faith. I do not believe that people should gratuitously attempt to insult Islam. That is not a good.
So you're in favor of censoring the Danish newspapers, just like you want to censor Cooper Union?
No, I'm not talking about censoring anybody. People have the freedom to make this choice.
Okay. But okay. Can we move to the next step here? Because you want to finish making your point? I'll just.
Well, the other point is, yeah, there is a choice here. This institution does get funds from the government.
Right.
Taxpayers are paying money to this institution, and we have a right to say whether or not we think it's a good thing or a bad thing for
Absolutely.
This school to
Absolutely.
Get our tax money.
Absolutely. I totally agree with you. We all have a right to weigh in on this, and we'll see where it goes. With less than a year to go before the Beijing Olympics, there is an urgent need. This from Reporters Without Borders. There is an urgent need for the government to stop blocking thousands of websites, censoring online news, imprisoning internet activists. Here we have the guy who owns the largest television satellite network in China voluntarily submitting to censorship and even participating with it. That would be Rupert Murdoch, the guy who owns Fox News.
Yeah.
Facilitating fascism. And I use that word very advisedly. We're talking about a brutal government that imprisons and murders people, that if you speak out, you're toast. I spent a week with the Dalai Lama in Dharamsala, India, a couple of years ago, and every day, literally every day, a little ragtag band of 2, 3, 5, 8, 10 people would show up who had made the trip from Tibet over the Himalaya Mountains, because we were in the Indian side of the Himalayas, who had made that trip, and typically, 3/4 of the people who set out on those journeys didn't survive the trip. They got killed by bandits. They were eaten by bears or lions. They froze to death. They starved to death. Families telling horror stories. There's one guy I talked to. His brother had a T-shirt with a picture of John Lennon on it. One of the Chinese soldiers thought it was a picture of the Dalai Lama, just walked up to him and shot him in the head. Right in a public place. I mean, there is a genocide going on in Tibet, and we're celebrating the Olympics in China, and Reporters Without Borders are saying, hey, isn't this pretty friggin' outrageous? And here we have on the front page of USA Today, Olympic visitors' data at risk, national security agencies. This is U.S. national security agencies are saying, you take a laptop or any kind of computer into China to cover the Olympics, they will. This is Chinese government industry use electronic espionage to easily access official and government and personal computers, equipment left unsupervised for just moments in a hotel or even during a security screening can be hacked, mined, and bugged.
Yeah, Tom, look, I agree with you 100% on this. And, earlier this year, I wrote a column about the ban on Bibles going into China for the Olympics. People can look up the piece on the website on CNSNews.com.
Oh, if you want to get a visa, you've got to submit your CV.
Tom, this is the thing. I talked to the spokesman for the PRC embassy here in Washington, and I asked him, what if I tried to bring into China a movie about the Dalai Lama? And I had to go around and around and around and around with this guy, but finally the answer is no, you can't bring it in. This guy essentially was telling me when people show up to be visitors in China to attend the Olympics, they will have their luggage searched to see whether or not contraband in the form of information that the Chinese government doesn't want out is not brought into China. It's not just Bibles. If you brought a movie about the Dalai
Lama. Oh, it's right across the board. It's right across the board. In fact, they're also now, if you want to get a J2 visa, which is a journalist visa, to go into Beijing to cover the Olympics,
right.
You have to submit, and this is, I'm quoting from the journalists, reporters with Reporters Sans Frontiers website, rsf.org. Journalists have to submit precise information about coverage plans in China, including the places they want to visit, the people they want to interview in order to obtain a visa, which is for media personnel. The BOCOG, the Chinese government, also requires a letter from an employer, which eliminates freelancers.
Yeah, it's absolutely ridiculous. And by the way, this is a communist regime. This is
I would submit to you that it's no longer communist, that it's now fascist. They have merged corporate and state interests and combined it with belligerent nationalism, and that's the old Merriam-Webster dictionary definition of fascism.
Well, I that's a good point.
So how do we tell Rupert Murdoch about this and tell him and Fox News to stop facilitating this stuff on the part of the Chinese government?
There is a phenomenon across the board where U.S. corporations or U.S.-based corporations want to go in and do business in China, and they want to go there for at least two reasons. One, to exploit cheap labor in China, and two, because the Chinese won't grant them access to this potentially massive market that they have unless they go into business with the government of China itself.
Right.
And when they do that, they take on these ridiculous rules and become partners with a regime that is as oppressive as any other.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. That's great. We can reach across the aisle and agree on this. I appreciate it. Terry Jeffrey, the editor of CNSNews.com. Good talking with you, Terry.
Good talking to you, Tom.
16 minutes past the hour. Robert Wexler up next. What was John Bolton talking about yesterday, and where should we take this?
Tom Hartman.
Uncommon sense from the radical middle.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
So many of them, poor boys off to fight a rich man's war, and we're looking at the possibility of another war, and to what extent might that be a war crime or an impeachable offense? Dennis Kucinich yesterday on the floor of the House of Representatives, reading articles of impeachment against George W. Bush. Congressman Robert Wexler, one of the few folks who, actually the only, I believe, the congressman from the 19th District of Florida, and the author of the forthcoming book, Fire-Breathing Liberal, How I Learned to Survive and Thrive in the Contact Sport of Congress, wexler.house.gov, his website. I believe the only guy to come out and say, yes, Dennis, we're with you. Congressman Wexler, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for having me.
Yesterday, John Bolton was on our program, and I was trying to get a sense of what this administration is going to do before Bush leaves office. And he was talking about how Iran was a great threat. And I want to play for you just 50 seconds, a little less than a minute, of a conversation I had with John Bolton yesterday. Here it is. There's no UN provision allowing us to attack Iran at the moment. This would be a war crime if we were to.
Of course it wouldn't. That's ridiculous. Article 51 of the UN Charter states that nothing in the Charter is intended to contradict the inherent right of individual and collective self-defense. So we would be operating under the inherent right, recognized right in the UN Charter.
So you believe the possibility that they could enrich to react to bomb grade represents a sufficient threat that we can invoke self-defense with a preemptive strike?
You need to read the latest IAEA report. All public information that the IAEA has on Iranian worked with shaped charges of high explosives, clearly intended for a weaponization capability. There's very little doubt what they're aiming toward.
So here he's saying there's no doubt about what this is all about. We actually had the spokesperson for the IAEA on the program Thursday. In fact, I sat live with her in New York. We did the show from the United Nations. And she said that there's no evidence that there's weaponization going on. And Article 51 of the UN Charter says, and I quote, "Nothing in the present charter shall impair the inherent rights of individual or collective self-defense if an armed attack occurs against a member of the United Nations until the Security Council has taken measures necessary, etc." Bolton, I mean, what's going on here? How does this tie in with, he's saying it wouldn't be a war crime. Dennis Kucinich was essentially saying this was a crime, the attack on Iraq, and therefore one on Iran would be the same. Let me stop talking and give you a chance to riff on this, Congressman.
Well, I think there are a couple of important points. Number one, Iran is in fact a grave danger, both to the United States and to several of our allies, including Israel in the region. We do know that Iran continues to enrich uranium in violation of its international obligations. We also know that Iran is the leading sponsor of terror in terms of their financial support with respect to Hezbollah, Hamas, Islamic Jihad, and other Palestinian rejectionist organizations. Having said that, though, however, the best course of action in my mind is for the United States to engage in the strongest, most principled type of diplomacy possible, with the aim of economically isolating Iran and preventing Iran from getting the financial resources that it needs in its energy sector, which is what propels their economy, and make it so that Iran becomes isolated not just from the United States, but from Europe, and then ultimately from China and Russia to the degree that we are able to persuade them. And
well, they have put a proposal on the table already saying that they are willing to have an international consortium run their enrichment facilities.
Yes, the Russians
to be totally transparent.
Yes, the Russians have proposed that. The Europeans, negotiating on our behalf, have proposed a number of different items, none of which thus far have been successful, and none of which have resulted in the type of economic isolation that we desperately need to procure.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the problem that we have under the Bush administration policy, being very candid, is that its economic incentives have not yet worked. We haven't created the type of isolation we need to create, and we're going to be left, unless we change course, with two very difficult choices, which is accept Iran as a nuclear power, which for me is an unacceptable reality,
right,
or use military power, which is also fraught with enormous problems.
Yeah, so the Bushies are setting this up. We have just 15 seconds left. If they were to do a preemptive strike before Bush leaves office, what should Congress's response be?
Well, this is something that Congress ought to be consulted with and ought to either approve or disapprove beforehand. It is an act of war, and Congress needs to be engaged with it. I would hate to see the United States do it preemptively only based on the presidential action.
Very well said. Congressman Robert Wexler, thank you, sir, and thank you for standing up with Dennis Kucinich.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Tom Hartmann radio program here on Air America. By the way, we're web streaming now over at airamerica.com/TomVision. You can find the link also at the top of our blog at TomHartmann.com, where we're running our contest for the best blog post. Congressman Wexler is still with us.
I
got off on this Iran tangent, and I really wanted to talk to you about impeachment, and my apologies.
Don't apologize. Yeah. It's not a tangent. It's a very important issue, and I applaud your focusing on it.
Well, thank you. But it's just, you know, the realities of commercial radio. We had 6 minutes. I did want to spend a couple minutes with you, and I know you have to go off and vote in 2 or 3 minutes.
Yes.
But your thoughts on Dennis Kucinich's impeachment resolution. We talked with Congressman DeFazio. I talked with him about 4 hours ago, and he said, you know, hey, why not just aggressively try to prosecute these guys next year?
Well, first of all, I applaud what Congressman Kucinich has done, because the Bush administration has systematically abused the power of the presidency. That is what we are learning, not just in one instance or two, but in several. Specifically with respect to the war in Iraq, we are learning more and more about the manner in which the Bush administration falsified the march to war, the way in which they fabricated evidence, the way in which they ignored evidence that disagreed with what they were attempting to do. We know that the Bush administration may have illegally authorized a spying program, not on terrorists, but on American citizens.
Right.
We know that they may have illegally ordered the torture of people detained by American officials that violates both American law as well as international law. We also know that they may have taken money that was appropriated for the war in Afghanistan, the war we need to win, and they may have subverted it to use it to prepare for the war in Iraq that, of course, was a discretionary matter, and that, in fact, may be against the law.
Right.
And to the answer of the question, why not prosecute them later?
I'm actually suggesting both, which is what Congressman DeFazio he said. You know, we need investigations, we need impeachment, but he said politically it ain't going to happen. So let's set it up for prosecution.
Well, he's right. One does not preclude the other, and I would argue, as I think Congressman Kucinich would, is that the Constitution is very clear in its division of responsibility, and where we stand today is that the Congress, in my view, the House, particularly as a member of the House Judiciary Committee, we have a constitutional responsibility to oversee the administration. And part of that oversight is to investigate and inquire about constitutional violations. And that's why we need a hearing or two or several with respect to these kinds of issues. I'm actually quite pleased that Chairman John Conyers has called Scott McClellan in to the House Judiciary Committee, and he apparently will be appearing on June the 20th. Scott McClellan can shed some light on several of these issues, particularly with respect to the outing of the covert CIA agent, Valerie Plame Wilson.
Right.
Also, now, with respect to the firing of U.S. attorneys, did the Bush administration violate the law?
In the Watergate hearings, I'm old enough to remember them, there was that moment when John Dean basically spilled the beans, and even the Republicans on the committee suddenly sat up and took notice. And then, of course, as the tapes came out, it became obvious that what Dean had said was right, and that Nixon needed to be impeached. Do you think that this might be that kind of a moment?
Well, I don't know, but that's precisely the point. Everyone, you know, likes to say, well, we know what will happen and there aren't the votes to do this or that with respect to the Bush administration. Going back to your point, the Watergate hearings, at the beginning of the Watergate hearings, there were nowhere near the votes to proceed against President Nixon. And as you rightfully point out, it was only as the hearings proceeded and the evidence came forth that it became apparent just how heinous the actions of the Nixon administration were.
Right, and it only took about 3 months for all that to happen.
Well, that's right. And the other point that I would like to make, Congress can do more than one thing at a time. Yes, we're in the midst of a very difficult economic time. People are having very traumatic problems with respect to their health care. Schools need a lot of assistance. We need an enormous investment in infrastructure in our country, and we need to get our troops out of Iraq. But there's no reason in the world why the House Judiciary Committee can't conduct the kind of oversight that the Constitution requires while we address these very important issues.
Right. Congressman, I know you have to go vote very quickly.
Thank you so much for having me.
Certainly. Should people call Conyers' office or just call their congressman?
Calling their representative is always a good way to exercise democracy.
Woman. Okay, great. Congressman Robert Wexler, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Great talking with you. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. And let's see, Edward in Oxford, Michigan. Hey, Edward, what's on your mind today?
Hi, how you doing? First and foremost, I'm 15, and I'm a huge fan of yours, Tom. So.
Thank you.
Yeah, well, I was just calling to discuss a couple of vice presidency positions for Obama.
Yeah, there's a lot of options on the table here.
There is. What are you thinking about Chuck Hagel?
I think that Chuck Hagel would be a terrible mistake.
You think so?
He is an opponent of the war, but right across the board on virtually all other issues, he has been voting with George W. Bush.
He does stay pretty conservative on a lot of issues.
Yeah.
You're right on that.
Yeah,
he is. Now, what about Tom Daschle?
Tom Daschle, you know, I don't perceive him as a strong guy. Personally, the guy that I think, you know, would be one of the top of my list, although he's not apparently on Obama's shortlist, is Sherrod Brown.
Now, what experience do you think that he has that would lead to a good vice president?
Oh, he was 14 years in the House of Representatives. He's been a couple of years in the Senate. He's been around the block. He knows politics. He's,
I mean, from the get-go, I've always thought Bill Richardson would make an awesome vice president.
I think he would, too. And frankly, I think that he was running for vice president. Edward, I got to move along, but thank you for the call, and thanks for bringing up the topic. I'm sure it's one that we will be pursuing at length as time goes on. Tim in Detroit, Michigan. Hey, another Michigan call here. Hey, Tim, what's up?
Yeah, Tom, under the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, Iran does have a right to develop a nuclear program peacefully.
That's right.
The IAEA has gone there, I believe, several times and has checked out the program, and it's always found that They're not developing any weapons of mass destruction.
And that's right. They're only the IA. Well, we had, as I said, last Thursday, I sat in New York City at the UN with the official spokesperson for the IAEA. But what happened is that under the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, Iran has the right to develop nuclear power, not nuclear bombs.
Right.
And they can enrich
peaceful.
Uranium up to 3% for nuclear power, not up to 95% for nuclear bombs.
They've only developed it to 3%, according
right.
to
the
IAEA.
Right, and that's what they're doing, according to everybody, pretty much.
Right.
But here's the problem. Here's the
about Iran being a grave threat. I mean, first of all, Israel.
I also disagree with him. In that language, I wouldn't say that they're. But here's the problem: the Security Council, which basically makes the rules, the Security Council has said to Iran, even though you signed the non-proliferation agreement, you cannot enrich uranium, period, anymore. And Iran has said, what, you trying to tell us what to do? We signed the documents, we made a contract, we're doing it, and we're doing it, transparently, but we're going to do it. And so now, because they are in defiance of the Security Council, the IAEA has to enforce the rules of the Security Council, not just the treaties. So the IAEA now is coming back and saying, okay, these guys are now in non-compliance.
So is this a question where the UN Security Council itself is not kind of following the NNPT itself?
It's a case where the Security Council is changing the rules of the game. And in my opinion, what they're doing is they're setting it up. This is the exact same thing that happened with Iraq. The Security Council changed the rules of the game several times. And ultimately, actually, Iraq, in every case, Iraq actually rolled over and said, okay, fine, we won't enrich uranium. Come on over and look. We don't even have a facility to do it. We won't make bombs. We won't make weapons of mass destruction. We don't have any gas. You can come over and destroy our missiles. We were melting down, crushing up their missiles, 2 weeks before we started bombing them. I mean,
absolutely.
Iraq, Saddam Hussein said, yeah, I'll go along with all, anything you say, I'll do it. And, as the Security Council ratcheted down harder and harder, Iran is saying to the Security Council, sorry, we got our national pride, we're a sovereign nation, and yes, we are enriching uranium, and we're doing it legally, and we're not going to let you push us around. And that's the problem, is it's created this impasse, and I think it's an impasse that frankly the Bushies love, and I think it's an impasse that was configured, that was set up by folks like John Bolton in the first place. And I think that Wexler was right in that in the segment before this, where he wrapped it up saying that the consequence of the Security Council going down this road, combined with the Bush administration refusing to negotiate with Iran, even when Iran puts forward suggestions like their deal with Russia, where they say, okay, let's have a multinational group here enrich the uranium, but we want to do it on our soil so we can have the national pride of saying this is our own program. Plus, Iran sits on a large amount of mineable uranium. So it's their own product that they're putting in their own reactors, right?
Well, it sounds like the Security Council itself is not bargaining in good faith, and maybe with a new presidency you could...
That's what Iran is saying. The problem is that's not what France is saying. That's not what China's saying. That's not what Russia's saying. And so, a lot of us who are, like you and me, who are just observers of this, are frankly, I'm a little baffled by this. I can see the U.S. taking this position. I can see France. You've got Sarkozy. He's a right winger. He's trying to cozy up to Bush. He thinks
you have Angela Merkel
right.
Now in Germany, of course.
Yeah, and Angela Merkel. She's moving to the right fast, but. Russia and China. I mean, Russia actually has, they can make big bucks if they want to be the ones who are helping run the reactors. I mean,
they want to sell them the arena themselves. That's what the Russians want.
Well, that too. Yeah. So, we're all going to watch. Tim, I got to take a break here. Thanks for the call. We're going to watch this thing play out, but it's, I think that this also may have something to do with why the price of oil is going through the roof. I mean, plus you've got oil tracking gold, which it typically does, or gold actually seems to track oil. Both of them are tracking the decline of the dollar, which brings us back again to Bush administration policies.
The Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Right here on the radio, the Tom Hartman Radio Program. And at the end of the show here, or actually in the last segment of the show, Sean Taylor, our producer, will be, our executive producer, is going to be looking through the postings on today's blog, today's show blog, at TomHartmann.com, right on the front page of TomHartmann.com, and picking out her favorite post for whatever obscure, random, rational or irrational reason, and that person will receive, she assures me it'll be rational, right? Okay. That person will receive a copy of my new book. It's now freshly out in paperback, Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What We Can Do About It. Lawrence in Berkeley, California. Hey, Lawrence, what's on your mind?
Yes, hi, good morning. Morning, Aaron. How you doing? You're talking about Iran?
Yeah, well, we've covered a lot of territory here today, and you're welcome to discuss any of
it. The important thing to remember about Iran is that their hardline president, Ahmadinejad, was essentially elected by George Bush.
A, and B, he has very little power.
Yeah, well, the fact that he was elected indicates that the entire society has turned more hardline. Because the previous president was Khatami. Khatami was a liberal. Khatami was the leader of a democracy movement.
Right. At least by Iranian standards, he was a liberal.
Exactly,
by our standards,
right.
He.
And after 9/11, Khatami wrote a letter to the United States via the Swiss embassy, saying, "Please, let's negotiate all our problems." There was an enormous sympathy in Iran for the United States. And the George Bush administration sat on that letter and didn't even reply. Then they invaded Iraq as well as Afghanistan and essentially had Iraq surrounded from both sides.
Iran, you mean?
Iran surrounded by both sides and called Iran the axis of evil along with Iraq, which meant that we are ready to invade
next.
You next. Yeah. And they created such a paranoia in Iran. I mean, if you ask the average Iranian, they don't like the regime of the mullahs, but they're afraid of the American invasion even more. That when the mullahs essentially...
No, Lawrence, I absolutely agree with your point. In fact, the analogy that I've made on this show in the past is that if Canada, for example, was to decide that they thought that George Bush had broken international law, that he had rigged the elections and stolen the election of 2004, or his friends on the Supreme Court in 2000 illegally installed him as president, that he was committing war crimes, that he was harboring weapons of mass destruction, that he was violating the Constitution, basically all the things that Dennis Kucinich indicted him for yesterday on the floor of the House. If Canada decided, you know, we can't, this is intolerable, this is on our border, and they started dropping bombs on the United States, most Americans would suddenly become very anti-Canadian,
mm-hmm.
even though we're anti-Bush.
Yeah.
Because, you know, the enemy of my enemy is my friend, I guess, but at a certain level, but my nation comes first, right? My nation, my mm-hmm. tribe, my family, my community, all these things come first, and there's that nationalism that will emerge. And so even if a state that we have a lot of respect for and that we like and is on our border and they're friends, and they speak the same language and all, you know, everything else. How much different it would, think how much even angrier we would be if it was Hugo Chavez who decided to start bombing us because he felt that George Bush wasn't serving us well. Mm. I mean, you'd have huge or Fidel Castro or, you know, fill in the blank. I mean, the point is that if we bomb Iran, we will solidify the right-wing extremists, and we will radicalize the Iranian population. And it's the absolute wrong way to go about this.
And we will triple the price of oil.
Yes, which is something that a lot of the countries in the Middle East would probably be very happy about, and as well as a lot of the oil guys, like our current president and vice president. They and their buddies will make out like bandits. There are in their mind, I think there are no losers. Plus, you know, you got the religious zealots who want to see the war in Armageddon start in the Middle East, and they think this may trigger that. And unfortunately, there's Iranians who think that way as well. And, you know, there's the Islamic version of the same thing. So anyhow, Lawrence, thanks a lot for the call and for raising you said it very well. And well done. Marianne in Long Beach. Hey, Marianne.
Well, good morning. Listen, I've been listening to your Iranian the news that you've carried in Iran. And I've been very interested because I've been kind of tracking this Blackwater thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that if Iran were invaded, it would draw off the rest of the military that we have here in the United States and make them weaker. And Blackwater would then be called in to perform the functions that the military currently do perform.
We don't have the ability to invade Iran. Iran has a million men in their army. I mean, there's just, it's not possible. What we have the ability to do is simply drop bombs on them, and that's all anybody's talking about. I agree with your analysis if we were to do that, but that's not going to happen. The biggest problem, though, you know, speaking of Blackwater, and thank you, very much, Marianne, for raising that topic. Speaking of Blackwater, the biggest problem, and not just them, but contractors right across the board. We have 300,000 men and women who are in Iraq right now, a largely Shiite nation, and if we start dropping bombs on their Shiite neighbor, Iran, many of them are banking in Shiite in Iranian banks operating in Baghdad through mutual trade agreements. Al-Maliki goes to Iran, they roll out the red carpet. Ahmadinejad comes to Iraq, they roll out the red carpet. I mean, these countries are trading partners. If we start dropping bombs on Iran, our soldiers and our contractors, our Americans, will become hostages in that country. I mean, this would be a terrible, terrible disaster. Tony in Ventura, California. Tony, we just have a minute before we got to wrap up this hour. What's up?
Okay. Tony.
Tony, you're on the air.
Oh, thanks. Tom, how are you doing today?
I'm fine. What's up?
Love your show. Hey, I just wanted to pose a question, not only to you, but to your listening public. If Iran is such a threat, can anybody name a country that Iran has invaded within our lifetimes at least?
Well, I think you'd have to go back about 700 years.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right.
I mean, because the Iranians actually consider themselves a separate race. They're the Persians. They don't even consider themselves Arabs. And so, they're not about, at least at the moment, expanding the Persian Empire. And according to everything I'm seeing, and in fact, the head mullah, the guy who's in charge of the country, basically, who pulls the strings, he has issued a religious decree saying developing and using nuclear weapons is a crime against Islam. I mean, it's, Tony, thanks for the call. To the extent that they're funding Hezbollah, that's a problem and needs to be addressed. But it needs to be addressed in a different way, but not bombing this country. 57 minutes past that.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
The Tom Hartman Program. The True People's Radio. Listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity.
Tom Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. 6 minutes past the hour. John McCain taking a little heat for a comment today.
And a lot of people now say the surge is working.
Anybody who knows the facts on the ground say that.
If it's working, Senator, do you now have a better estimate of when American forces can come home from Iraq?
No, but that's not too important.
No, that's not too important. When they come home. Oh, man. So anyhow, McCain is saying that he was misunderstood. We'll see. And this plays to a larger issue. To what extent are Americans easily bamboozled? Sometimes you know what you know. Sometimes you don't know what you don't know. Sometimes you don't know what you do know. Sometimes everything, in fact, as the Fire Sign Theater say so well, everything.
You know that you're wrong, but you fear you're right. You suspect you're out of sync. Think that you're out of your mind.
Everything you know is wrong.
Well, okay, just how stupid are we facing the truth about the American voter? Rick Schenkman is with us. He's the author of a new book, Just How Stupid Are We? And, Rick, by the way, the website is howstupidblog.com. Rick, welcome to the show.
Glad to be here.
How stupid are we?
Well, I don't really argue in the book that the American people are stupid. I think that would be as stupid as saying the American people are smart, which is what you hear from politicians all the time. It's a dopey, gross generalization and doesn't get us very, very far. But here's what I do say. I do argue that our politics are often stupid, and the reason is that American voters just aren't very smart, which is a little nicer way of putting it. And politicians count on Americans not being smart. just in the paper this morning. I just finished reading the New York Times. And here we have right on the front page of the paper, McCain asserted in a speech in Washington on Tuesday that under Mr. Obama's tax plan, Americans of every background would see their taxes rise. Well, it's just flat out untrue, as the rest of the story, which continues on page A20, explains. But in the meantime, why does McCain say it? Because he thinks he can get away with it. He can paint Obama as a taxer and a spender, and that's sufficient. Because the people won't read on page A20 if they even read the headline on the front page. So the people are sitting ducks for manipulative, wily politicians. And I want to live in a country of smart voters, not manipulated voters.
Yeah, there were a couple of points in your book that I thought were fascinating. For example, you talked about how when Walter Wandale said that the only difference between him and Reagan, both of them would raise your taxes, but Mondale would tell you the truth about it and Reagan would lie about it, that initially the American people said, okay, that makes sense. And then as the Republicans took that soundbite and turned it into a bludgeon to trash him, that he was toast. He was toast. And then Reagan ended up raising taxes.
Sure, of course. He raised taxes some 7 times during his 2 terms.
All right, the largest tax increase in the history of the United States, on the middle class anyway, you know, doubling of the Social Security taxes.
Exactly. But nobody talked about that. Nobody, you know.
Well, to this day, nobody talks about it.
People would refer to his tax increases as, or he would refer to his tax increases as raising fees.
Right.
You know, it was all nonsense, but he bamboozled people.
Yeah. See, now, just to take this right down to where the rubber meets the road, as it were, I have been pointing out on this program for the going on 6 years that we've been on the air now, or we're now in our sixth year, that a big problem happened in the 80s, and we watched it happen. We had kids in school in the 80s, and as well as just, you know, being observers of the political scene, and that was that during the Reagan administration, there was this campaign that was kicked off that is still continuing now on college campuses with David Horowitz and his whole, you know, hunting down professors who might be liberals or communists, and people, you know, encouraging kids to take tape recorders to class and find out, you know, find them, you know, let's find the next Ward Churchill kind of thing. But that was happening in our high schools in the 80s. And there was all this hysteria around liberal teachers and union members, and it's the NEA and all this kind of stuff. And the upshot of it all was that there was essentially a purging of civics from our high schools in the 80s and a consolidation of all the textbook publishing among a small handful of textbook publishers who all had to vet everything out of Texas. And in fact, on page 177 in your book, you say what's needed is specifically an emphasis on civics, not just, you know, more or better schooling. Expand on that.
Well, first of all, let's talk about the paradox. Americans have been getting smarter and smarter over the last half century, at least in terms of the number of years they spend in school, at the same time that our politics have been getting dumber and dumber. In 1940, 6 out of 10 Americans hadn't gone past the 8th grade. 6 out of 10. Today, most Americans have gone to college. And yet, on the survey tests, which are done by the University of Michigan every year and by other outfits, Americans on most questions about civics score the same as their parents and grandparents, and on some very vital questions actually score much, much worse. In the 1950s, if you asked Americans to articulate the difference between the two main political parties, the Democrats and Republicans, almost all of them could do it. Only 10% couldn't. In the 1980s, they asked, and 27% couldn't come up with one thing to say about the difference between the two major parties. So we've had that decline. And I guess my argument is that we need, if you want to have smart voters, you've got to teach smartness. It's not enough to have education. It's a myth to say, oh, we just need to send more kids to college. No, it's what you're teaching in college. And if we don't have
or in high school. Or an elementary school.
High school. If we don't emphasize civics, then you get results like this one, which to me is the most mind-blowing statistic of all the ones I came across. Only 2 out of 5 Americans know we have 3 branches of government and can name them.
That's fewer than half of all Americans.
Yeah, we don't even have a majority who understand the most basic facts about our government.
Right.
And so how can you have a conversation about politics if people don't understand the basics? And of course, because they don't understand the basics, our conversation winds up not being about substance, not being about the various tax plans, for instance, that Obama and McCain are putting forth, but instead, in that same paper today, you have on page A21 a little story about the Michelle and Barack Obama fist bump. And if you turned into cable TV over the last week, you saw that's what they were talking about constantly. And why? Because it doesn't take a PhD to have an opinion about that. But right. if you're going to start talking about economic policy, well, that might actually be a little bit taxing, and pardon the pun, and people tune it out. It's boring. Oh, you know, who needs it?
Right. And so what we end up with is soundbite politics that is not even honest. It's dishonest soundbite politics. And frankly, it's a game that has to be played on all sides to a certain extent, simply because that's the level of intellect, political intellect, of our voters. And, you know, de Tocqueville, in 1838, when he wrote Democracy in America, when he came to the United States in 1836 and traveled around and then published his book, he was astounded. He wrote about how the average, you know, he would walk up to a farmer in his field, and that person could discuss the arcane minutiae of domestic and international politics. How far we have fallen. You suggest we should be teaching civics in our schools. I absolutely agree. One out of seven Americans can find Iraq on a map, you point out. Only one in five Americans know that there are 100 U.S. senators. Or for that matter, why? You know, why each state has two senators or anything like that. You know, the history of America, basically, is not being taught. What can we do over the short term? How do we deal with the fact that we've got basically a stupid electorate, to use the title of your book, just how stupid are we?
Well, here's the argument I make in the book, that the most important thing we can do, first of all, is we have to recognize we have a problem. I wrote a piece this week for my website, the History News Network, and the headline is American Democracy, the 10-alarm fire we're ignoring. The 10-alarm fire that we're ignoring has to be faced. Let me give you some statistics. On the eve of the Iraq War, a majority of Americans, between 60 and 70%, thought that Saddam Hussein was behind 9/11.
Right.
And 80% of those people who backed the war cited this as their chief or one of their chief reasons.
Right. And the statistics were much higher, and the statistics were much higher for consumers of Fox News versus NPR or Progressive Talk Radio.
Exactly. And those are some of the statistics that I say. And so what you have here is you have a situation where we can't even count on the American people understanding the most basic facts about the single biggest event to strike this country in the last generation, since the Kennedy assassination. This has been the biggest thing, and they couldn't get the most basic facts right. Well, you can't run a democracy that way. You can't run it very well. Now, we're big, and we're powerful, and we're a rich country. So, you know what? We can afford an Iraq disaster, and we'll just continue. We'll just stumble forward, and we'll just keep going. We can afford a Katrina.
I think we can. I think it's killing us. But
Over the long term, it will. But because it's not killing us immediately, right now, right here and now, we tend to not face it.
Right.
And I say we got to face the fact we got a 10-alarm fire in our democracy.
Amen. Rick Shankman, Associate Professor of History at George Mason University, recently elected Fellow of the Society of American Historians, the editor and founder of George Mason University's History News Network, howstupidblog.com, his book, Just How Stupid Are We? Thanks, Rick.
Thank you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Fighting for the common man and the common good.
The Tom Hartman Program.
Jolly good fellow alert here. Congratulations to Congresswoman Barbara Lee, Ron Paul, and Sheila Jackson Lee. They have organized a Time to Talk to Iran event on Capitol Hill, along with the campaign on a new American policy in Iran, Physicians for Social Responsibility, and the American Friends Service Committee. And talking about dialogue. And in the news story about this, you can read it, it's up at the top of commondreams.org. In the news story about this, they point out that Nouri al-Maliki, the Prime Minister of Iraq, was in Tehran, Iran, on Sunday, Now, you know, wrap your brain around this. The president of Iraq, or the prime minister of Iraq, was in Iran with the president of Iran, and actually with the head Ayatollah, and the Iran's, here's the from the news story. During a Sunday visit to Tehran by Iraqi President Nouri al-Maliki, Iran's Ayatollah Ali Khamenei stated, quote, "The presence of occupiers in Iraq, particularly the U.S. Armed Forces, is the main obstacle to unity in Iraq." A Gallup poll, by the way, found that 7 of 10 Americans favor direct political and economic engagement with Iran instead of military action. But, you know, it's like, do we have a stupid electorate? Is that going to be a problem? I don't, you know. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Ian in San Francisco. Hey, Ian, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. Yeah, I think you may have reported the other day, and I've heard it on other shows, that it was reported that John McCain was getting $58,000 a year tax-free for 100% disability.
Yeah, that's actually the Los Angeles Times reported it on April 22nd, and here's the first two sentences. Senator John McCain has long said he's in robust health and is strong enough to hike the Grand Canyon, but he's also receiving what his staff Monday termed a disability pension from the Navy. When McCain released his tax return for 2007 on Friday, he separately disclosed that he received a pension of $58,358 that was not listed as income on his return.
Okay. So anyway, I didn't know that it had actually been reported in some specific journal like the LA Times. But so I called his office and I asked him what the disability was, because you know, depending on the disability, that could be really important.
Well, his staff identified this again from the story. McCain's staff identified the retirement benefit as a disability pension and said that, quote, McCain was retired as disabled because of his limited body movements due to injuries as a POW.
Okay, because they weren't really obvious, you know, what the disabilities were, and
He can't clap his hands over his head because his arms were broken when he was, you know, when his plane landed. They weren't set right.
Okay, well, maybe other veterans know about, you know, what it takes to get 100% disability, but, I mean, if you're fully able, as his doctor recently reported on his medical condition, that he's fully able to serve as commander-in-chief and president, it was like, it didn't fit.
Yeah. That's a topic that, and Ian, thanks a lot for the call. That's a topic that we need to bring up with Larry Scott one of these days, because he's the expert on all things veterans benefits. And what we don't want to have happen is essentially means testing of veterans benefits. On the other hand, if somebody is 100% disabled, then you would think that they can't work. But I don't pretend to be an expert on this. I do think that it's an anomaly that is going to be a problem for McCain. So, you know, we'll see. We'll see as time goes on how this all shakes out. Dan in Paterson, New Jersey. Hey, Dan, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to make a comment about is anyone looking at the tax ramifications right now, for instance? The truck drivers are now paying in excess of maybe $5 a gallon for their fuel oil.
Right.
Now, that's $5 a gallon that they are deducting from their taxes that they're paying as cost.
Right.
So we're talking
about... It's also reducing their profits, which are taxable, which I guess is essentially the same thing that you just said. And because our tax in the United States on petroleum products, on end-use petroleum products, gasoline and diesel, unlike European nations, our tax is not a percentage of the cost. It's a fixed amount. So it was 17 cents, you know, depending on the state, because you got state and federal taxes. Say it was 17 cents back in 1980, it's still 17 cents. Whereas
right.
In Europe, if it was 17 cents in 1980 and now the price of gas has tripled, it's three times 17 cents.
Right.
So we're not seeing an increase in the revenues.
So, well, not only are we seeing an increase, we're seeing a deficit in the revenues.
Right, right.
In our tax coffers. So that means we're going to be having shortages at the end of the year or at every quarter, depending on how they pay it. I'm assuming they pay it quarterly. So we should be already seeing quarterly deficits in in the Treasury.
In the Treasury, yeah, absolutely. And this is broadly referred to as an economic slowdown. I mean, you know, when companies right across the board, because it's not just truck drivers. I mean, companies right across the board because of the cost of fuel. Look at the airlines. I mean, they're freaking out. And, you know, the cost of food is going up because there's secondary costs associated with it. Basically, the cost of everything is going up because you have to put it in a truck and get it someplace, and or on a train or on an airplane. Yeah, you're absolutely right. And this, Dan, this is a piece, and thanks a lot for the call. This is a piece of that whole, which is the destruction of the economy of the United States at the hands of the Bush administration. Because of the destruction of the dollar. Because of Reaganomics. Because it all goes back to Ronald Reagan's crazy economic policies!
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Today. I don't know what it is. Something's wrong with our eyes.
And welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. The Tom Hartman radio program. And let's step out of our left brain for a minute and get into our right brain. Peter Yarrow is here in the studio with me. In fact, if you go to TomHartman.com and click on the link to the AirAmerica.com/TomVision, you can see us both in the studio. Peter Yarrow, the singer-songwriter, founding member of the folk trio Peter, Paul, and Mary.
Thank you for that acknowledgement. Founding members. There were only three members, and we're all founding members.
Oh, really?
I was still singing. And Mary, by the way, which we were discussing before when we first got together today, is doing a lot better. She had to conquer acute myelogenous leukemia.
Oh, my.
And she had a bone marrow transplant, yeah. A back operation, and we're going to be touring again this fall.
Oh, that's wonderful.
And, you know, for those people who are saying, you know, it's real, they're really worried, she is great. I just spoke to her yesterday.
That's
so
great to hear.
Hallelujah. And, but send her your love, okay?
Yeah, for sure. PeterPaulAndMary.com is the website, and you're in town here in Portland for a fundraiser for Mercy Corps. MercyCorps.org is that website, and that's going to be a great gig. But first of all, your thoughts on the state of politics today, Peter?
Well, my sense is that we have, for the first time since the 1960s, and I feel this, even I was just over at a school for kids with special gifts and needs, and I was saying, well, for those of us who marched in the March on Washington, Selma, Montgomery, who were a part of the women's rights movement and the Equal Rights Amendment passing, to see that Barack Obama has been a candidate for the president is an astonishment. And it's not just, and also that a woman, Hillary Clinton, has risen to the height where she was a viable candidate, right, and might indeed be an important member of the cabinet or who knows what. To say that, we have the opportunity for the first time now, as we sit here together, to say that democracy may be rejuvenated in this country, a democracy that has been squelched, desperately struggling under this administration, because anybody who really opposed the positions of the administration was labeled seditious or at least unpatriotic. Yeah. And so I see this as the most exciting time, but it means that it reminds me of that moment in 1968 when finally the movements had an electoral political candidate in Eugene McCarthy and for others in Bobby Kennedy. And instead of sticking with it, people just lost their heart after the 68 debacle in Chicago. This time, we can get when I say our, I mean a person who represents what these marches and these movements and that sense of equity has been all these years. We can get that in office. We have the opportunity throughout the world. They're looking at the situation. They're saying This can happen now. This is the democracy U.S. was supposed to be.
Amen. And in honor of that, would you care to sing a song?
I still have a hammer. And I still got a bell. And I still got a song to sing all over this land. It's still the hammer of justice. It's still the bell of freedom. And the song about love between my brothers and my sisters all over this land. All over this land. And we can sing this now, knowing that maybe in this country we can say with liberty and justice for all, and know that the people who are in Guantanamo, that maybe when they are released, that we'll have the guts and the clarity to go to them individually, if not as a country, and say, how can we have done this to you without due process? We'll have the guts to go to the people of Iraq and say, how can we have done this in the way that we never did to the people of Vietnam? We'll have the opportunity, once again, without being labeled seditious, to say, we will have equity in this country in terms of the haves and the have-nots. And we won't have the top 5% having extraordinary amount of money and those who are disenfranchised less and less and less. And we will not have acrimony and divisiveness as the word, where people are forced into silence by the tools of Goebbels, yeah. You know, where you frighten people.
We're talking with Peter Yarrow. He is the Peter of Peter, Paul, and Mary. PeterPaulAndMary.com, by the way. And he's live in the studio with us here in Portland, Oregon. Another little sound bit, Peter?
Yeah, well, you know, young people here, they don't know what it's like to have, struggled for what we've achieved.
Yeah.
And so they don't understand how important this moment is. Folks, it is time to rejoice.
You
can rejoice it. You know what? Even a song like this becomes relevant. The line it is drawn, the curse it is cast. The slow one now will later be fast, as the present now will later be past. The order is rapidly fading, and the first one now will later be last. For the times, they are a-changing. We are talking about a time when we are living on the cusp. Do not fail.
Yeah.
Understand that this is the crucial moment for us. If we fail to do this now, I've lived so many moments. The past 7+ years have been the most distressing, the most dangerous. My great fear is that in some way this president, actually, I don't think he is, he's not, you know, I don't think he actually was.
No, he was installed by a judicial coup.
That's right.
By the Supreme Court, but nonetheless,
he's
the guy who's got the power right now.
He is the official president, but I'm saying if he doesn't make a deal with the Israelis to invade Iran, and the saber rattling is getting louder and louder, you know, which would be horrific and take us, if we will have a time in which we will be able to say to each other, the answer, my friend, is in all of us, is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind. How many years can a mountain exist, a mountain of prejudice, before it is washed to the sea? Yes, and how many sea years can some people exist before they're allowed to be free? Maybe, maybe, maybe more and more will be. How many times can a man turn his head and pretend that he just doesn't see, unless he is sociopathological, in which case he can't see. The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing. Can you imagine singing these songs and feeling that they are not just whispers from the past when there was idealism that is no longer relevant? And do you hear how these songs resonate with our times?
Is that the experience that you're having as you tour around the country, that not just people of our generation and age, but
yes,
young people who are re-experiencing, or they're discovering for the first time, we're re-experiencing this.
Yes.
It's like deja vu all over again. But you're experiencing that change.
Well, I am, as I was just telling these kids, in this wonderful school that with kids with special gifts and disabilities, that I said, now it is possible for everybody who is a female in this room to say, a woman has successfully become a candidate in one of the parties for the presidency. There is no chance that anybody that is female is not proud of that. And everybody nodded. There's no chance that every person of color in this country says, I can now strive to be a part of this society because I am not excluded the way I was before this. Do you realize what that means for a person who marched for these things?
That's an incredibly powerful
and
thing.
Everywhere I go. But your job, my friend,
yeah,
your job, Tom, is to let them know that this is not only the time for intelligent discourse on these topics, but this is time to get deeply involved. If we miss this opportunity, we are indeed
absolutely
missing the boat.
Absolutely. Peter, we're talking with Peter Yarrow of Peter, Paul, and Mary. You know, Achillea millefolium is the botanical name for the yarrow plant, which is years ago in another incarnation, I was an herbalist, and it was one of my favorite medicinal plants. Let's take a break and come back and maybe hear another song and perhaps take
Absolutely.
A few phone calls from our listeners if we have any calls, anybody who would like to talk or has something that they want to bring up with Peter Yarrow. We're going to take a break right now. It's a Tom Hartmann radio program on Air America Radio, 45 minutes past the hour. And I'm going to ask our call screener to go through our callers, and if anybody has questions for Peter Yarrow, we'll put them up next, and we'll wrap the show up that way. I think it's just perfectly appropriate. Stick around. And you can see this live on the web, the video of it. Go over to TomHartmann.com. There's a hot link there.
Tom Hartmann.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
Bumper music. Peter Yarrow, Peter, Paul, and Mary. PeterPaulAndMary.com. He's in town for a fundraiser for just a great charity, an international charity that's based here out of Portland, Mercy Corps, MercyCorps.org as well. And Jake in Eureka, California, you have a question for Peter Yarrow.
Yes, I do. I'd like to ask Peter if he supports Dan Kucinich's call for the impeachment of Cheney and Bush.
Oh, I impeach that in principle. Certainly, but I think strategically right now we have to focus not on hammering the other, but inspiring each other. This is a time to say, there is a time for the singing and the sunshine. There is a time for the thunder and the rain. There is a time for the changing of the seasons, my friend. We know that too, but there is one thing We must never change. Don't ever take away our freedom. So now what we got to do is we have to understand that to create further divisiveness with those people who are going out at this point, yes, we need to hold these people accountable, but right now we have to solidify our efforts and not create the kind of animosity.
Yeah, in fact, the Obama campaign apparently is opposed to the impeachment effort because they're trying to reach out to Republicans to vote for Obama in the fall. And,
yes.
And he's got a lot of, it's a startling number of Republicans are saying, I'm going to vote for
you
Obama.
Know why?
So.
Because he has not bought into the entire system of a long list of people that have made his political career possible. He has reached out, and he will reach out.
Yeah.
My hope is that he'll reach out to something like Colin Powell for the Secretary of State and show it, live it, walk it.
Wow, that would be the healing of the nation, I'll tell you.
Wouldn't it?
Larry in Torrance, California. You're on the air with Peter Hero.
Thanks, Tom. Peter, I was at Cornell in the mid-60s, where I not only got to hear you perform, but also recall your being instrumental in opening up the fraternities. We had what we called back then white houses and Jewish houses.
Yes, yes, we did.
And
yes.
You, I guess it was Aide Pye, helped bring in blacks into the fraternity. And
that's been legendary
for 40 years.
Well, I'll tell you, I don't know what I can claim in responsibility for that, but I remember singing in Romp and Stomp, where I was an instructor in that class. It was the only undergraduate instructor. And I was singing songs to Cornellians at that point who were completely devoid of the kinds of thinking and talking that we're sharing today. And I was singing very simple songs like this.
Thank you, Larry.
I asked my love to take a walk, we'd only walk just a little ways. And that was a Southern Mountain Murder ballad, but in singing together, it was just like singing, we shall overcome, we shall overcome. We shall overcome. And then, you know what? That was the kind of confirmation that helped us to move forward, that singing and heart connection. And I believe that what we need now in this time of the possibility of the switching from the intimidation and the animosity and the acrimony in politics into a politics of forgiveness. America is not.
We need a reconciliation commission.
We need
like South Africa.
Truth and reckon. Yeah. We need to examine what we have done that is wonderful and celebrate it. And we have to look at what we've done in Vietnam and Iraq and say we must make amends as human beings and as a country.
Amen. Ray in Memphis, Tennessee. You're on with Peter Yarrow.
Hey guys.
Pretty short on time.
Listen, I love Peter and Tom. I'm your age. Went to college at the same time, the whole bit. Grew up playing some of Peter's music. But I have to tell you, I think the message in the song that you opened with, which is beautiful, is not, please don't take our freedom away. It should be something like, let's not give our freedom away, because with all the stuff that's happening, the pushback is not there. I mean, I know the guys like you are doing it. I'm doing what I can do. I'm a professional creative for a living. But there's not enough people. It takes physical activity to stand up and say no, just like it did in the 60s and the 70s. There has to be more people on the street with signs. It can be after work. It can be at lunch. It can be any time. But it takes consistent physical activity to be in people's face on the way home.
Ray, spot on. We only have a minute left,
we'll
so let's
never
let, Peter...
let them take away our freedom. Point well taken.
Yeah, it is.
We'll never, never let them take it away again. We must cherish and keep that one part of our lives. And we will be together, respectful of our rights, my friend. Thank you. I'll give you co-publishing credit on the changes to this song.
Well done, Ray. Ray's point is well taken.
It is up to us now, through inspiration, through a commitment, to recognize that this moment is the most crucial moment. I never thought in my lifetime I would see this possibility. We must take advantage of it, and Air America is the place to have the conversations.
Well said, and thank you for the endorsement. Peter Yarrow of Peter, Paul, and Mary, peterpaulandmary.com, live here in our studio in Portland, and for Mercy Corps, mercycorps.org. Peter, thanks so much.
Thank you, my brother.
Good to see
you. A great pleasure.
It's great to have you, to be with you. Tomorrow, Ralph Reed and Bob Barr, Libertarian candidate for president, and your calls, of course. Don't forget, my friends, activism begins with you. Democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it! We'll see you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit TomHartmanRadio.com.
That's T-H-O-M Hartman with two N's, radio.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.